Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of Kansas City Fellowship and the author of three books. The latest is Some Say They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, the Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to be back, and I'm aching and anxious to get into this topic, as we talked about last time. And I was listening as I was editing the last video, and I kept crying squirrel because I kept going towards the entertainment. I'm just dying to get there to talk about. You and I are aligned in this. We're aligned in many things, but specifically this. We want to know why things are such a mess. Why in the world, in the name of Christianity, are all of these people doing unchristian things, and worse than that, claiming divine authority while they do them, as though they're inspired directly by God to do them? This, you know, I started obviously in the William Branham cult, and I started researching to find why he did it. But as I'm researching, I find, well, he's one of 1,000 people, 10,000 people that are doing the same thing. Why are they doing it? And it led me in my history way backwards to, you know, the early ancient religions with the ancient theaters and the ancient, we've talked about this, it's basically entertainment. It was ancient entertainment. It was spiritualized back then. It's spiritualized now. It's a mess. So today, as I said, I'm dying to get into it, but we're going to talk about entertainment.
Well, you know, if you're just tuning in and you don't really have any context for our discussion, because this is the second part of something we started on the last session. And I talked to John a month ago about the fact that I've been fascinated watching all of the social media posts about pointing out what all these various ministry celebrities are doing wrong. What I'm not seeing any discussion on is what's wrong. And the reason why this is important is that if you go back and you refresh your understanding of Jesus, one of his main parables was the parable of the sower, right? Which you see in Matthew and Luke. And what he talks about is soil. What's the soil? There's good soil and bad soil. And so what I'm really been wrestling with is, what's the current state of the soil of the American church? Because we keep having the same bad fruit. We keep having recurring problems, right? So what we did, or the reason why this is important to me, because as everyone knows, if we don't get to the what's wrong problem, we're doomed to keep repeating the same problems, right? This isn't going to go away. This is just going to continue to be cyclical. So what we talked about last episode was the fact that there's been this gradual infiltration of cultural narcissism, and it's become our new norm. It's all about me, right? Which we all laugh about, which previous generations would have found utterly distasteful by and large, right? Has become acceptable and even lauded. You know, look at me. You know, it's really consumed the last three generations, and a generation is usually 20 to 25 years, right? So what has that produced in the church world? Things that are so normal to us, but previous generations would frown on, right? It's a phrase that we hear all the time, my ministry, right? Like, that's when people say that, we don't even think about it, but is it your ministry, right? If you're a servant of God, is it your ministry or is it his, right? Ministry has become a marketable brand, right? That's something that's really new. Try to publish a book or get a record deal, right? Nobody cares if you have great content or you have a prophetic word from God. What they're interested in is, do you have a marketable brand with followers, and can we make money?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you might have the most brilliant idea in the world. Nobody cares unless you have a brand. And brand is now associated with people, right? Churches and parachurch organizations are now run like enterprises, right? They're run like businesses. This all started in the 1980s when church consultants became a thing. I remember it vividly. I was planning a church, right? And all they did was simply take business principles and put Christian verbiage on them. And so what ended up happening was is that all these pastors and leaders got trained to run a business under the guise of it being a church, right? Something to think about is, from the beginning of colonial America until the 1960s, preachers confronted people about their self-centeredness, right? Repentance was a thing. Like, that was a word that you heard a lot because you were repenting from your selfishness, your self-centeredness. Now, you go to church and you're told how wonderful you are. You know what I mean? I mean, again, we're stepping back here. We're looking at all this, right? The whole self-esteem movement that Ayn Rand, we talked about Ayn Rand's objectivism, right? That self-fulfillment and personal success is the goal of life, and how this infiltrated all of our academic institutions, and that then infiltrated the business world and all these sectors of society, right? Well, I remember when it infiltrated the elementary schools, right? We were telling Johnny how wonderful he was. Well, what did it produce? A whole generation of brats. Little brats, right? Who ended up having a collision in adulthood when they realized nobody really cared about Johnny, right?
So I was reading through the comments of one that we recently did about the heresy hunters. Uh-huh. And we both just really asked the question, are they helping, are they hurting? We really never came to a conclusion. But it's funny, if you read through the comments, those who think that we did come to a conclusion strongly objected to whatever conclusion they thought we came up to. But at the same time, many people missed the context of what we were saying.
Right.
And I think for the relevance to this episode, I think I need to clarify that just a bit. So a lot of people don't realize this. Not many people are public speakers, and those who are, of those, not many people are really out in the public. And so there is this problem that exists, and nobody is immune to it, including myself, wherein when you speak in a very public audience, you are looking at your audience to see, did they accept you or did they reject you? Do they like what you say? Do they dislike? You're always wanting that, not just the feedback, but you're always wanting the assurance that you're doing what is correct, you're saying what is correct, you are what you're saying is on the mark, and it is appealing to your audience. Now take that thought and apply it to a religious setting. Whether you're a heresy hunter, whether you're a minister who's oblivious to all of this, or whether you're one of the ministers that are the targets of the heresy hunters, all categories have the same issue. Once you enter that thought into the spiritual realm, if the audience likes it, well, God must have spoken through me, and the audience must hear my divine voice. And whether you're a heresy hunter or not, that comes out. Now, not every heresy hunter, and I'm using that label very loosely, be aware of that. It is probably derogatory, purposefully so, for the title and for the YouTube caption, so people would click it. But there are people who are in that with really, really good intentions, some of which aren't doing that at all, but others who don't realize that they have the God complex at a much lower level than their targets. I'll just say it like that. The more you speak, the more you speak with any sort of authority to a public audience, you're going to get that God complex, and nobody is immune, myself included. I have an unusual help in all of this, in the fact that I am so far out of my element. I do not like public attention. I'm the guy, My wife used to, we used to talk about this with my wife because it's odd that we even connected. In any sort of gathering, I'm the guy that's standing in the corner watching everybody else make fools of themselves while I'm sipping coffee. That's my personality.
Yeah.
So I'm not immune to the God complex thing that I'm describing. However, I don't like it. And whenever people started, there was a point in time in which the people who would call me a heresy hunter started saying, John's preaching, John's preachy, he's gaining a following, John is creating a cult all of his own. I actually walked away from all of this because I don't want it. That is not me whatsoever. But the problem does exist. And I must mention, for the entertainment's sake, this is a problem in that the entire movement that we're about to explore and get into in this podcast, it was built on the framework of entertainment because it could draw a crowd, because it was a business. It was backed and funded by people called the full gospel businessmen, funded by the Kardashians, leaders in the entertainment industry. This was an entertainment movement that started with Latter Rain.
Out of LA.
Out of LA, developed into Charismania, developed into the NAR. So everything that I'm saying applies. And
I mean, you go back to Amy Semple McPherson. Same thing, L.A., drama queen. I mean, we can go on and on. We'll get into some of that stuff. One thing that I'm fascinated by right now is now that some of these scandals, as it were, have sort of got time and distance, there's this thing starting to happen about these guys coming back into ministry. And what fascinates me is the psychology behind it, or the worldview, which is, I'm so important, I'm so essential to the church world that it needs me. I can't sit on the sideline, right? In other words, if I'm not involved, you know, what God wants to do isn't going to happen. Again, you see the narcissism that's crept into this whole thing? You know, I've watched many famous preachers reach old age and disappear into an old people's home, you know, where they're wearing diapers and all this stuff. And guess what? Nobody cares. Life moves on. You're old news. And it's a real struggle because it's suddenly I'm irrelevant. Like, I thought I was, the world revolved around me, and suddenly, wait a minute, I'm not all that important anymore, right? And that's a brutal reality check that I've had to walk through with a lot of men. Like, oh my God, I'm not as important as I thought I was, even though I had this big following, right? But, you know, as Jesus learned, you can have lots of followers, but what's driving them, right? Gimme, 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 you know, feed me.
Absolutely. And that's really, for me, that's the biggest thing, right? A lot of people who are in Christianity don't realize that aspect. So they go to one of these apostles or prophets thinking they're going to God's divine spokesperson, not realizing that it is all about that person. It's not so much about God. And so they're just shocked and overwhelmed when the person is shown to be human and have human sins and human problems. Suddenly, oh my gosh, this guy, he was a scoundrel. We need heresy hunters to come in.
And it's, well, what's helped create this environment that we're in is the second piece of this equation, which is that we've adopted this culture of entertainment, right? Which is, I know, because I deal with the burnout and the fallout of the guys who don't measure up, aren't as good of entertainers, right? And end up burning out and leaving the ministry and end up hating everything and everyone because they're giant failures. One of the questions that I've been wrestling with is what happened? Like, how did the church world go from laying your life down for others, you know what I mean, a sacrificial, caring about others' focus, to it's all about me, and I need to entertain everyone, right? That my job as a pastor or the ministry or however I'm going to build my brand is I have to be an entertainer. So how did that happen, right? Because that's happened, again, in our lifetime. Like, this is not something that's historical that goes back thousands of years. This is something that's happened in our lifetime. That shift, just like the epidemic of narcissism, has happened with, and I don't think people realize how we've become increasingly passive as congregants or people that attend church, right? Where and we've become more and more passive and expect others to do the heavy lifting, right? We expect them to produce the content, them to produce the show, and then we show up and get entertained. And if we're not entertained, we just go to the next place. I just think about my kids' generation, right? I'm watching my kids' generation. Well, how do they pick churches? Where their kids have the most fun. So guess where they naturally gravitate to? These big mega churches that are like Disneyland for kids, right? It's a spiritual version of Disneyland. So their kids can be what? Entertained, right? We can drop them off at youth group. We can drop them off at, you know, at Vacation Bible, right? You know, we can just let them do the work. So, you know, they can be entertained. And so what's happened is this whole entertainment culture has put so much pressure on preachers and pastors to perform.
In my latest book, the Christian Identity to the NAR book, and we actually spun an entire podcast series called Weaponized Religion on this, but the problem that we're talking about, even though it is specifically dealing with entertainment, it's a very complex issue. It isn't, you know, when you're in these movements, you're trained that it's black or white, there's one cause, but there's actually multiple sources of background that are causing this. One of the biggest of which is Christian identity. And the reason why I say that is a factor. There was a point in time in which, you know, Christianity, after the war, Christianity was becoming something far different than it was before the Second World War. And the Christian identity leaders feared that the people were leaving Christian fundamentalism and entering into more liberal forms of Christianity. Yet at the same time, many of their fundamentals in fundamentalism were not really Christian values, but were more political values or Christian identity values. And so you had this wide swath of Christian before the evangelical movement, people who eventually became evangelicals, this whole swath of ministers that wanted to make the nation sway itself back away from that liberal Christian viewpoint into Christian fundamentalism. And one of the ways in which you do this is you make it more appealing. If the liberals, Christians want to go a certain way, part of it was branding. They branded normalized Christianity as cold and formal religion. If you're a Baptist, it's cold and formal. If you're a Methodist, it's cold and formal. If you're a Catholic, it's certainly cold and formal. The Catholic Church is the villain in this case. So what they did was they branded everybody who wasn't part of the movement as cold and formal, and then made the new the new version of what they were creating far more entertaining. So when people went and they saw the entertainment, when you compare entertainment to what they're considering to be cold and formal, well, yes, wow, this is entertaining. I can feel the spirit. I can see the stage act moving. This must be God in our presence. So one of the contributing factors historically was that liberal versus fundamentalist debate.
Yeah, I think one of the other contributing factors to this entertainment culture is technology. And let me share some stats, which I'm sure you're aware of, but maybe some of the listeners would find this fascinating. Before 1920, humans got their entertainment and their information via newspapers, books, or attending gatherings, right? Somebody was an adventurer, they went to Africa, and then they would come back to the U.S. and they would go on tours, and we'd all go to an auditorium and listen to them tell stories, right? I mean, they'd have spellbinding tales. But, you know, you were, again, you were active. You had to read the books, read the newspapers, go to the meetings, right? Then in the 1920s, the radio became a household device, right? So now we're talking 100 years ago, and families now could stay home and gather their news and their entertainment by listening to this little box that had, you know, voices coming out of it. I mean, that's my mom's generation. I had many stories of everyone sitting around listening to Roosevelt during the Second World War, or, you know, she grew up in Chicago, so you had all these little shows. But one of the things that you needed when you had a radio was you used your imagination, right? Because you heard the sounds and the scripts and all that, but you had to picture it in your mind. So you were still actively involved in the process. What ends up happening is after World War II, in the 1950s, the TV starts becoming popular. You know, in 1946, there were only 6,000 TVs in the country. By 1950, there were 12 million, and the average person watched a TV 2.5 hours a day. By 1960, there were 55 million. So you can see now the adaptation of this technology completely changes how we get our interaction, or we get our information and how we interact, right? I've told this story before. In 1983, the VP of Sprint, which was just down the road from the church, and he was one of our congregants, came into my office and basically prophesied. I mean, and what I mean by prophesied, told me the future. So in 1983, he told me that the future was the world was going to receive their entertainment and their information on a 3x5 rectangular screen, which I just thought was like, wow, like really? Like this was, you know, science fiction at this particular point. Well, you realize this is 1983, he's telling me this. The first photo to show up on a phone happened in 2002, right? So nearly, it was two decades later before what he prophesied to me in 83 actually came to fruition. And it was 2007 that the first iPhone came out, right, with the 3x5 screen. And I remember when I got my first iPhone going, oh my God, this is what he told me back in 83 was going to happen, right? What people don't realize, though, is that Apple recruited psychologists to help design the iPhone. And the red dot and the ding, they figured out were, guess what? Dopamine injections. They made the iPhone addictive. Like, it was purposely designed to addict you to it, right? In other words, this wasn't, oh, an accident. That they actually designed it so that it would keep, so every time your phone dinged, you'd go, you know what I mean? Or every time, you know what I mean, you saw that red dot, you couldn't say no. I had to go see what that is, right? And the whole idea of notifications became a thing, right? So think this through. You know, we ended up creating now what I call ADDOS culture. So attention deficit disorder, OS means, oh, shiny. It's like, right? We look for things that are shiny and entertaining. The average American now spends 7 to 8 hours in front of a screen and 4.5 hours being entertained every day. I mean, think about how significant of shift this is just in the last 100 years, right? So what's it done, right? It's created this whole world, because out of every hour of television you watch, you're going to get 15 minutes of advertising, which tells you you need this, this, and this. And if you want to be cool, you'll wear this and you'll drive that. And what did that produce? Materialism.
People don't realize or recognize the power of suggestion and manipulation that they go through from day to day. I'll never forget, I had a client that took me, I can't mention which one, but one of the big hotels that everybody's familiar with in Vegas. I got to meet with their CIO, who had been there for I don't know how many years, but
It was an interesting meeting because he was there back whenever the gangsters ruled Vegas. And he says, everything's different now. He said, people walk in this wearing the shorts and t-shirts. And back then they would call you out and you might blow up in a car bomb if you did that in the old days. You had to dress nicely, but everything's changed and everything is more about the the excitement than it is about the actual gambling. He said, back when the gangsters ruled it, you could do all kinds of things to rig the gaming, but now the industry is so controlled that what they're doing now is actually more powerful than what the gangsters were doing. When you walk into the casino, and I wish I could tell which one this is, but I'm certain they're all like this. What you see in the casino and what you see in the massive mall that is associated with the casino pales in comparison to the data center that's under the thing. And in this data center, they're capturing algorithms with everything, every piece of information they can buy, scrape, get. When you walk in the door, and this was years ago, so some of this technology sounds familiar now. It didn't back when he told me. So when you walk in the door, it does a facial scan and facial recognition and tries to match you to a passport or ID. If it can do that, it knows your address. Then it goes out and it finds out, who are your neighbors? What is your culture like in your neighborhood? Are you in a rich neighborhood, poor neighborhood? Are you more likely to gamble or more, you know, it goes through all these scenarios. By the time that you sit down at a slot machine, it knows more about you than you know yourself and more about your neighbors than they know themselves. And
isn't that Minority Report where they had advertising, right? It scans you. It's like it knows who you are. And then suddenly it's got you in all these different clothes. And
Well, one of the tools that he said that they'd use for manipulation, and nobody catches this, unless you're there at like 4 a.m., you don't notice it. All of the machines at random, if nobody's on it, start dinging. So while you're in the meeting or while you're in the gambling room and everybody's pulling the slot machines or whatever, you hear this other person that sounds like they're winning and there may not even be a person there. That's legal. You can do this, but it is a mind game they're playing with you. And if you, the facial recognition could tell if you're suddenly getting sad and there were spotters who would watch for sad people, they would bring you a free drink on the house to keep you excited in the moment. And it's all part of manipulation. And what I'm talking about is...
So to tie this back into your latter rain world, right? Because now we're going back to the 40s. When I was picking Paul Kane's brain about, you know, that world, because it was so unfamiliar to me, he was telling me about how a lot of these tent revivalists would go into towns and do something scandalous so that they would appear on the front page of the paper, right? It was before cell phones and whatever, but it's that whole thing again, right? About, look at me. You know
what I mean? That's exactly where I was heading with this. So what I'm talking about is Vegas and my IT weird business, but in practice, and in fact, I can't say who, some of the revivalists were attending Vegas meetings in secret and all kinds of other things going on. There's a bigger story there.
Right.
But when these revivalists would go into town, if we're talking tent revivalists, they're doing it. If you're talking modern day apostles in big conventions and auditoriums, they're doing it too. There is no news that's bad news. If there's a scandal happening, that scandal can attract people to it just to see the curiosity of the scandal. So you may have this big influx of people into a convention who don't believe at all, but they're there for the scandal. Then the subset of people who's probably smaller, who is there thinking that this is divinely inspired by God, and oh my gosh, look at the thousands of people here. They must be inspired by God to come to this too. But it's all about that scandal, and it's all about the manipulation and the psychological tools that they're using. Now, take that a step further towards the stage persona. When you suddenly come to terms with the fact that no news is bad news, scandals bring crowds, now it's like the get out of jail free card in Monopoly.
Yeah.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started?
or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
How has that shifted now with technology? We don't have to go to the meeting anymore. We can watch it all online. we're all following the scandals now on Twitter. And we're following the scandals on Facebook, and we're right. In other words, again, now we don't even have to leave the comfort of our couch, and we can be in game. But what are we doing? We're tuning in, right? We're all tuning in. And so, again, what's ended up happening, and without even realizing, it's like the, you know, the old frog in the boiling water, which isn't actually true, but it's a great analogy if it was. It's the slow burn. And it's happened with narcissism. It's slowly crept in and become so normal. And because it's happened over decades, people have lost perspective. And they don't realize where we are. Again, why are we figuring this out? Is because of our personality. We're standing back from the crowd, looking at this like historians, over decades, and you see, when you see it, like when you step out of the situation and don't need to be the person being entertained, and you can stand back and you look at it, you see these huge cultural shifts, not only in our secular society, but in our church culture. And that's why we're trying to explain to people we're in this mess because we've made it all about us. We've become narcissistic and don't even realize it. And we want to be entertained. And if you don't entertain me, I'm moving down the road to the next guy, right? So again, I'm going to be a little bit, I hope this doesn't come off too hard, but the narcissism side of it, I look at as problematic on the leadership side. The leadership has this problem of narcissism more than anyone else. That's why they rush in to wanting to be in the ministry. So I can get people to pay attention to me, right? I can be the center of attention. The entertainment problem is on the other side of the equation, which is the people in the congregation. They're the other half of the problem because they're creating this culture where if you don't entertain me, make me feel good about myself and tell me what I want to hear, right? How about that? There's nothing new there, right? Remember, before Jesus in Isaiah, say to the seers, see no more visions in the prophets. Give us no more visions of what is right. Tell us pleasant things. Prophesy illusions, right? Or in Timothy, for a time will come when people will not put up with sound doctrines. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths, right? We've become that. It's like, tell me what I want to hear. Entertain me. And so what happens is it's in some ways, it's a bad brew, right? You have narcissistic, driven people who want to be stars, right? They don't think as ministry as being, I'm a servant to all. I want to be a star. I want to be a Hollywood star, only I'm in the ministry world. That's what I mean. Go back to the Amy Semple McPhersons and that whole, the entertainment culture, right? I want people to show up in these auditoriums and think I'm the most wonderful thing and that I'm God's servant. Blah, 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 blah. And on the other side of it, we want people to do that. You see what I mean? We're feeding it because we want to be entertained. And so it is, you know, as Paul said in Romans, all have sinned. And in this situation, it's really easy to sit in the chair and point the finger at the leaders. But what I'm trying to communicate to people is, no, we're part of the problem.
The other thing it does, and I know I'll get pushback on this because this is heavily taught in the opposite, but what they've done in creating this atmosphere is trying to push the notion that there are some sins that God views as greater than other sins. Biblically speaking, if you go back and you look at all of the examples of sin, there are sins that have consequences that are greater than, but in God's eye, all sin separates you from God. It's not something where they, for example, we had a person on the podcast who in the past had been homosexual. We had a whole slew of people contacting me saying, no, man, you can't have him. He's ruined for life. He can't come back. He can't be on your podcast, and I'm not going to have you on the podcast with you, because they have indoctrinated people to think that this is the sin above all others in today's world. It's a politicized sin, and therefore it's greater than the other apostle who's doing X, Y, and Z. But that's not the way it is in the Bible. In the Bible, at least the passages in my understanding from reading them, there are consequences to those sins that are far worse. For example, if you were to, you know, tell a lie to somebody, well, that lie, the consequences for you are simply you told a lie, but the consequences for the person you told it to, they may go off and do something horrible because you did. That consequence, is that worse than killing somebody? All at the same time, they're all sins. It's just there are consequences and results from the sin that are different. But the way that they've twisted it through this entertainment environment is they've categorized sin in such a way that it's a hierarchy. And interestingly, if you study it enough and study the men who preach it and women who preach it enough, that hierarchy usually tilts in one way or another depending on their own sin and their own lives. But at the same time, they're elevated to apostle status, and they can easily be returned back into the ministry. And, you know, predators can get more prey because they've been forgiven and they've been restored back into the ministry by these guys. They've created a hierarchy of sin in which they control, and that hierarchy is all part of the entertainment system.
Probably my first real, I want to say, revelation or grasping about how this shift has happened, this entertainment culture in the church, actually surrounded my first book, which I released in 2007. And it's the story of 16 of the most amazing people who were killed on a peace and reconciliation project in Zimbabwe. Now, historically, they would have been considered martyrs. Right, all through church history, people who died for their faith were martyrs. So I'm writing this book because I feel this unction from God that their story not get lost, that it gets recorded and, you know, it's put in print. I'd like to make a movie out of it someday, but I can't. Everybody wants to make some really weird religious movie out of it, and I want it to be gritty and real. But anyways, long story short, I go into Mardell's, which was the big Christian bookstore at that point, to see where my book would fit, right? Because I want to get the message out. So I walk into Mardell's in Overland Park, and they have this big wall of the top 20 selling Christian books. And I'm reading all the titles, and every single one of them was about how you get something from God. And I'm just looking at this going, oh, Lord, have mercy. Like, my book is all about losing everything for God, and yet all the top-selling books are about these three steps, these five steps. Like, there was this whole, all these books were all processes, right, for how you can get blessing from God. So you can get better status or higher status and more money. It was basically the status and stuff thing, right? So I'm like, oh my gosh, well, obviously I won't be in the top 20 best-selling books, but maybe there's a place for this story. So I go up to the desk and ask the lady, do they have a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, right? Which is a historically classic book. And she looks at me and goes, huh? I go, you know, Fox's Book of Martyrs, right? And she had no clue what that was. And so she looks it up and goes, oh, we have one. You know, and it's back over here in this section. So all three of us walk over there, and nobody can find it. And my wife, like, looks down at the shelves underneath all the displays and pulls it out. It's buried under. She goes, God, we've had this book for years because nobody's interested in it because we are an entertainment culture. And as I learned the hard way when I was sharing my story in LA, somebody yelled out back from the back of the room, bummer, man, we don't want to hear about people dying. And that's when I began to realize, wait a minute, things have shifted significantly, right? People don't want to hear about martyrdom. They want to hear about losing anything. They don't want to hear about self-sacrifice. I mean, people like Elizabeth Elliot, you know who that is, right? Whose husband, you know, the saints, all those people that were, I think it was Ecuador, where they were all martyred, right? I mean, she was a rock star, you know, from the 1950s all the way up. But as time went on, her story became increasingly more relevant. I remember her and I talking about this, you know, and the pain she felt. Like, it's like, what's happening to us? Like, where are we going here? Like, something's wrong here. And now we're way down the road. And it's just like, wow. Tickle my ears. Tell me what I want to hear. Entertain me. I want to go to church on Sunday. You know what I want to do? I want to walk out there feeling good. I want to have had fun. I'm thinking, wow, no wonder we're in a mess. Like, we are so far off the reservation from what Jesus taught and his worldview and how he thought about, right? It's like, wow.
You know, key point in view that for this discussion, Fox Book of Martyrs is one of the propaganda books used by William Branham in the Latter Rain movement. He wasn't the first, obviously, but it is heavy, heavy, heavy psychological bias against Catholicism. It does have some facts in it. There are factual statements.
Well, because of the Inquisition, yeah.
Yeah, there's some facts in it, but it uses a whole bunch of hearsay, and it's not considered a historically accurate book. It is more.
No, but it was a, you know, one of those required readings almost, yes, at every Christian college, right?
And it's okay. I'm not saying anything bad about the book, but you have to take it with a heavy, heavy grain of skepticism, right, which is all part of the problem that I'm describing here. They use things like this as manipulation tools. And, you know, I'm not pro-Catholic. I'm actually not as anti-Catholic as some people who comment on the threads, but You can't go to both extremes. You know, if you want to say something about the bad about the Catholic Church, stick with the things that are actually factual. Mm. But then the Catholics can do the same thing about, look what we have in Charismania and in the NAR. Mm. They can, right, do the same exact thing. There has to be this balance, and there isn't.
But I think I'm more fascinated by just the shift in John the Baptist saying, I must decrease so he must increase, you know, which is kind of the Fox's Book of Martyrs, you know, thing. It's like, I'm going to lay my life down for others. Two, I must increase. It's like, you know what I mean? And how do I increase? By entertaining everyone, right? In other words, you don't increase by telling people to lay your life down for others. You don't have a ministry. Nobody's listening to you, right? And so, again, we're creating this soil for narcissistic people who want to be the center of attention to stand up, right, and feed us all what we want to hear. So One of the things that, now we'll shift this into the whole prophetic. The reason why I actually, my last book, the one, Some Said They Blundered, the original title for it was Prophetic or Pathetic. I shifted it only because of my relationship with David Pitches, who wrote Some Say They Thundered, which was a complete fantasy presentation of what was going on in Kansas City. But again, what's happened to the prophetic? Again, it's entertainment. I wrote about this in the book. I watched guys like Mike and, other people put these prophetic guys out in front of audiences, and Mike was like P.T. Barnum, and this was the three-ring circus, and we're going to entertain. And I watched 5,000 and 10,000 and 15,000 people all excited because of a word of knowledge, right? It was entertainment. It had no relevance to anyone else but maybe one person. But even in that, a lot of it was faked, right? Because, again, and I talked about this, I think you and I've had this conversation, I watched the pressure on the prophetic guys to produce entertainment, which led to the bullshit, sorry for the phrase, but it was like religious bullshit, because they were feeding people sensational stories, right? And sensational things, because there was all this pressure put on them to entertain. Because if they didn't entertain, they didn't get any money.
Yeah, I've mentioned several times, whenever I left this, I wanted to wash it out of my head. I kept reading the Bible over and over. Many things stood out, but one of the things that stood out, because we were also enthralled with the prophetic. When you read the prophecies in the Bible, it isn't what's your name and what's your address so I can heal you. It isn't that stuff. It isn't what's coming in the future. What is there going to be a radio broadcast with Joel's Army in Training and all of this weird stuff in the future? Can I peer into my crystal ball for God? Yeah. Right. Those were the bad guys. If you read the Bible, the bad guys are the ones that are doing that kind of thing. The prophets, the actual prophets of Yahweh, were more to the point of, you've sinned, you need to clean up your lives, you need to humble yourselves, you need to get back to me. Me being God, not me being the prophet.
Yeah.
And I took a step back and I started thinking, it was all about me in this prophetic movement, but me wasn't the same me. It wasn't I am that I am. Mm-hmm. It wasn't God. It was
that's right.
Me the prophet. What can I do? How can I enthrall you? How can I convince you of my supreme deity as a prophet by telling you something in the future that you can watch happen and see? And more to the point, because I know how all this works, I was watching it work. How many random facts or how many random predictions can I throw out, some of which are predictions based on facts that I already know, and see which one sticks so people will think I'm a prophet? I know you've probably seen this. Many of the people who are in the inner circles have seen it. That's how all of this works. It's not that there's this great prophecy. And people are often shocked if there ever is a recording, which usually they avoid it for obvious reasons. If their original prophecy is ever recorded and somebody hears it years later and thinks they're a prophet because of it, they go back and listen to it. Well, that doesn't sound like a prophet. That would be like me saying the Chiefs are going to win next Sunday. Well, yeah, if they win, I can't say that I'm a prophet. I say that I guess pretty good. Well, many of these prophecies are like this, but solely for the purpose of entertainment, because if it does happen, if all of these random predictions happen, you're going to get this crowd of people that say, whoa, the prophet.
Well, to circle back to the very beginning of this, when we were talking about soil, I think to your point, that's what the prophets of old focused on. The state of our individual and national soil, right? In other words, motive, our value systems, how we've deviated from the heart of God. That's what the focus was. So in other words, being a prophet was pointing out to individuals and we'll say corporate. When I mean corporate, I mean nations, you know, groups of people, that you're missing the mark here, right? Which is what repentance basically is. You're missing the mark. That's why, you know, the word repentance is a big word for profit. And why? Because they're saying you need to repent. You need a course correction here. You need to get back on track. And I think that's the real heart and soul of the prophetic. The whole entertainment culture that has so infiltrated the church world has created the showmanship of what we have now called prophets. And I think it's so distorted. Like, it's sad in a way. If you want to get, you know, you like facts, the truth be told, screenwriters, musicians, and authors outside the church world are far more forthtelling and more accurate about the future and what's going to happen to humanity and events than anybody in the church world. Not even close. And that's one of the things I find embarrassing, is we're so unable to self-evaluate and be objective. Like, we think we're this big deal. And you're like, you guys, like, 90% of these prophetic guys missed the mark. Like, we're down here in the 10% right phase, and we just think that's awesome. Like, in every other genre of life, that's gross failure. That's terrible results. Like, every company, if you had 10% success in a football team, you're in last place. If you have 10% success as a company, you're out of business. But somehow in the church world, we hang on to the one guy who got it right the one time. And you're like, well, the odds, just guessing, will give you the same rate. It's the supposed revelation, right? It's like the same odds are there. But when you look back at significant projections, foretelling, people outside the religious world have been far more accurate. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, one of the guys I talk about all the time is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who came here in the 70s and told us all where we'd end up now. Back in the 70s, he told us exactly where we were headed as a culture. And here we are, just like he said.
And next time, I want to get deeper into the random predictions that are thrown out. So right now, you may not be aware of this, but Charisma Magazine loves William Branham, and they continue to publish his alleged 7 prophecies of 1933, of which he also said 1931, 1932. Like the Mormon prophecies, he says, and I wrote it down on this piece of paper, which you, my cult, will never ever see, because I buried it in the cornerstone of my grandfather's church. And at other times he would say, now I'm going to read this letter that, oh, by the way, I mentioned was buried under the cornerstone. Nobody's ever seen this thing. Well, nobody really catches that the 7 so-called prophecies change. And Charisma Magazine loves, when something happens, some world event, they love to say William Branham was right. Whenever Kamala was elected, she came out onto the platform, there's a big picture of her, and they said, was William Branham correct? And they were insinuating that he was, because William Branham predicted that a vice president would be a female. But the original telling of this prophecy was that the president, not the vice president, would be female, and because I'm such a misogynistic freak, that's going to lead the whole world into destruction because America elected a female president. Well, over time, that shifted to vice president because he apparently wasn't, his randomness wasn't working. Right. And so Charisma published the second iteration of this when Kamala was elected vice president. Well, recently, there's a United States Pope. What people don't realize, who don't, you know, if you're never in the Branham movement, you don't know this. It started out as a female president. It shifted to a female vice president with a male president. That shifted further to John F. Kennedy, because he was strongly against Kennedy. Then later it shifted again to a United States Pope would be the one to lead. So it's the same alleged prophecy, but it keeps changing because they're throwing out these random predictions that may or may not happen and then calling it prophecy. Right. Charisma and other similar tools that are out there like this, they're manipulation tools. They want to give the entertaining idea that this was a real prophecy, which it wasn't.
Well, so why do they do that?
Yes, for money.
They got to sell magazines. This is what I'm money. Saying. This whole entertainment culture thing is so infiltrated that they're going to put up sensational, because sensational and controversial, what does it do? It sells.
Next time or sometime after that, we'll talk about random predictions that become prophecies. I think there's a lot there, but anyway, another story.
Well, you're a stat guy. I wish we could somehow or another, create some sort of stats, like if we could figure out what percentage of prophecies actually.
Well, and I have the software to do it. If everybody out there listening will send me the failed predictions and the accurate ones, yeah. I will compile some stats. So anyway,
all right, bud.
If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion from Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle and IHOP KC, you can read Some Say They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer.